Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I find it difficult to associate them with being brave or being fearless or it being adventurous, because I think that the people that I found when I was there are, in fact, you know, it's their part of the world, and there isn't it, as an imposter doing a job for a week or 2 weeks.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and episode 65 with George Butler. George is an award-winning artist and illustrator who specializes in travel and current affairs. George's desire to record scenes in ink rather than with a camera means he's witnessed some extraordinary things over the past few years. In 2012, he walked from Turkey into Syria, where he drew the war-torn town of Azaz, as a guest of the rebel Free Syrian Army. In this episode, George speaks about the extraordinary moments he's witnessed, the pressure to get his art right, in inverted commas, and how he struggles with the concept of bravery. This episode is a real victim of the recorded online situation we found ourselves in over the past year. George was speaking to me from a block of creative studios in London, where others were having fun in the background with a staple gun and a chainsaw. That's right, a chainsaw. I didn't see that coming. The sound quality is okay in places and pretty ropey in others, but stick with it. George is an incredibly interesting guy and it's worth it. Okay, over to George Butler. I guess an obvious place to start is, who are you, what do you do, and how do you make your money and live your life?
Yeah, all good questions. My name is George Butler. I'm an artist and illustrator, and I rather kind of grandly began to call myself an artist reporter, which is just a way around of trying to explain to people who ask what I do beyond illustrations, which obviously evoke an idea of some children's books or some beer mats or whatever. So it's the work that I do is I go to places in the world that I think are interesting or misunderstood or on the edges of the front pages, but perhaps didn't make it because of a COVID story or a Brexit story or whatever the story is that day. And I sit down and I draw them. So my job, albeit I think sort of self-appointed, is to visit places that I ordinarily wouldn't understand very much about, but know that there is more to it than we see on our front pages. So. Borders of Syria and Iraq and on oil rigs and in courtrooms and down gold mines Anywhere where I've sat down and people have come up to talk to me, and the picture that I was drawing that I thought might be a good looking thing to draw then suddenly becomes a story. The drawings that then follow are me trying to do justice to what they've told me in their words. It's supposed to be, but the reportage aspect of it is supposed to be about them, whoever they are and whatever the situation is.
Okay. And so this is, it's an obvious, silly question, but why not just photograph them and write about them?
I think, I'm biased, but I think there are fantastic advantages to drawing. Originally, it was used to engage audiences sort of all through the 18th, 19th centuries, and still today, it wasn't just we were waiting around for photography to come along. We wanted to know what these things looked like, and we were emotionally attached to the representations that artists made. That, of course, is totally shortcut by this sort of obsession and the magic of photography, and may never overcome it again. But there is, I think, a value in something that's made by hand by one person of another, and there's a sort of ability, another I guess it's the sort of care and attention that has gone into it that means that it can be equally powerful. So I think that stacks up. And I think it's interesting when you have a page or you're scrolling through loads of photography for it to be punctuated by illustration. But more than that, I think perhaps this is talked about a lot on here. It's very much about, to use a kind of trendy word, process. And you simply don't get a chance to sit down in a place and spend time with people who, in the situations that I've found myself in, unless you've got a reason to do it. It isn't good enough just to sit down. Sometimes not good enough to sit down with just a camera. Sometimes it's not good enough to be there with as a role with a job in these parts of that world, but in those parts of the world. But with a sketchbook and a pen and a paper, because it's open and people can see what you're doing, and it's just a pen. There's no camera. As Paul Hogarth described it, as a handshake. It's a kind of introduction to a place, and you don't need to speak the language, but as long as you're willing to sit down and be in the corner and not ask too many questions, you're allowed to be there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I've experienced it hundreds of times where you want to ask somebody if you can take their photograph, or sometimes you just take their photograph, and there's a moral and ethical question around that, obviously. But do you just sit down and start drawing, or how does it work?
I just sit down and start drawing. And I mean, that's not always true. It most of the time I sit down and start drawing, and because it seems so unthreatening, and because the drawing doesn't to start with look like anything, you sort of get permission to do it, because if people are willing to do it, then they will just sit there, or they'll just carry on. That's the aim, for them to carry on without really paying any attention. Obviously, there have been cases where I have sat and interviewed and drawn at the same time, and then you get a sort of combination of the two. It goes without saying that they are giving permission, because they can see it and it takes 25 minutes or 20 minutes. But obviously, I do ask in those cases.
I realize we're diving in deep to start with here, but to what extent is the artwork and are the drawings the specific exact representation of what you're seeing versus how something feels or what a person said?
That's a very good question. Obviously, I think they're brilliantly accurate. I've noticed something about drawing in places like Mosul in Syria and drawing people that were telling me their stories. When I felt like it was an extraordinary scene. So this little town in Azaz where the war had rolled through 10 days earlier and there was a tank and some kids playing on it. I found myself being quite incredibly uptight and just sort of obsessive about making sure that I got every single detail right in my mind, and so that somebody else could see what it looked like, that it was important to get the shape of the tank so that was recognizable. It was important to get the mosque that had been knocked down as if it was recognizable. I don't think they necessarily make the best pictures. I think if I was drawing a bunch of flowers or a fruit bowl back in the studio, or then you can be expressive and fill those moments with feeling, but there is a sort of tension that I can almost feel talking to you about it now, kind of nervousness to make sure that getting it right is sort of happens. I suppose it's a bit like being nervous when you're trying to speak, you're like, do some public speaking. It almost makes it better because there's a real pressure in your voice to get it right, and that is even more true when you sit down in front of somebody and they're telling you their experience of the week before. Or there's this drawing I did of a lady called Mama Nazik, and it was 10 years ago now, but I'll never forget it. But she was telling me a story of her, one of her sons who had died, and one had been blown up and another had been shot in the back, and they were all roughly my age. And I suddenly realized that she was telling me, because I was a similar age to her sons, and there was this sort of pressure to suddenly draw, and she was just sitting right in front of me, and it was a sort of extraordinary moment to try and put down on the page everything I was trying to do was focused on making it look like her, so that I wouldn't forget, and I could tell other people about it. I think that's it's a good question. I think there's a real balance between loosening up and being expressive, which is what, of course, all the art teachers and schools are telling everybody to do, versus accuracy. The two aren't binary.
Or right or wrong.
Yeah, definitely not. To answer your question a little bit more, you're doing that thing very well where you just leave a silence and then just let the other person speak. Oldest trick in the book, but I'm going to fall for it. And then to fill in that a little bit more, I think the best drawings that I do when I feel like I've done my job have been away from editors and commissions, and I've just discovered a place or a person, not for the first time, but just on my own, and I've thought that's what I want to. I know that the people I know and don't know about this, and I've made 10 or 15 drawings and gone to describe it, taken photos and sent them back to newspapers.
It's very interesting as a methodology. You said that, I mean, I guess as a pre-screen for coming on here, you listened to the Michael Turek episode, and that's, probably the most arty, creative podcast I've ever recorded.
Right.
I'm
that had some good process in it.
He talked a lot of, I mean, that was all about process, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Very interesting man. But this is about you, not him. And look, you're talking about breaking fourth walls, talking about technique and segues. Where does this all begin? Where does the love, what comes first? The journalistic streak and curiosity or the art?
I think, well, the other day I got to 35 and thought, just carved this like unique path. And then I realized that actually it is exactly what my mum basically does. And that is to, she doesn't do it in the same way, but she's an art teacher. She writes about it, and she's drawing obviously at home in rural England. But I sort of set out thinking that I was doing something totally different, and then realized that I hadn't really done anything different at all. And the drawing part for me became, it was an excuse to sort of be peaceful and sort of go off on my own at school and learn something that I love doing. And that there's two sides of it. One is that kind of obsessive nature that lots of artists have of making a perfect picture, and every picture they start wants to look good. And there is an illusion in copying what is in front of you, which I think people enjoy. Well, in the places that I go is often a thing that attracts people to come look over your shoulder, because you're recreating something that they recognize. It might be their friend, it might be their street. It may be not a very good representation, in which case it's even funnier, better reason to sort of invite you in for tea and be engaged. And so there's that part of it, creating something that looks good. And I found that it was my excuse for going to different parts of the world that I would otherwise never have crossed paths with. And the drawing is the reason to go. And so it's sort of like sitting down and taking notes on a place, that sort of like being in a lecture. It's my way of learning about it and remembering it. And when you make a mark on the page, it sort of has this sort of, I can often remember like pieces of conversation when I'm looking back over drawings, because I don't know, there's something linked with your hand and your mind that kind of jolts your memory. So the stories definitely followed afterwards. I'd learnt to draw before, and then not, interestingly, I don't think they're reliant necessarily on good drawings. I think it helps, but I think the better stories and the better bits of journalism don't need fluid, beautiful economy of line, you know, that we aim for in the life drawing classes. Maybe it's an excuse. I think actually, this is a bit of an admission, when I started doing this, I thought my drawings weren't very good, and so I think I started by thinking, well, if I can just draw extraordinary things, then I can disguise some of the kind of the bit that, you know, that I don't want to draw faces or whatever it was. So I think certainly to start with, I remember getting set a project at university about reportage, and I thought, right, I'll just pick the most extraordinary thing I can think of and plunge myself into it. And I got permission from a plastic surgeon to go into his theatre and draw this little girl who was having a mole removed from her nose. And what they did was they pumped a balloon into her forehead over 6 months. So you got extra skin growing so that it would stretch the skin. Then when you took the balloon out, you had extra skin in which they would cut the mole off on her nose and fold the skin over. So in the last operation, they take this balloon out and you can see the skull and the nose and the eyes of this four-year-old. And there's about five highly professional doctors with a sort of world of experience about doing this operation. And then there's a sort of pressure, isn't there? Then you've really just got to get on with it. There's no excuses. You can't rub out. You can't stop. They're doing something truly extraordinary, and you're just trying to show a bit of it. So it kind of calls your bluff, and you've just got to get on with it.
To what extent is drawing something extreme or something very visually powerful a method of you know, and I'm being deliberately difficult here, either hiding behind something that's already amazing versus you feel an immense pressure to perform and that works for you?
I think to start with, I used the taking a big white sheet of paper and a pen and a dip pen and ink as a way of learning to draw. And if you want, and I would still use it now, and I still teach it now, to put down a pencil and get rid of a rubber so that you've got, you know, you've really got to concentrate on where the line goes. You can just always work over the top of it. There's a boldness there that helps. But now I think it's a way of, I use it in that sense, and I use it as a way of getting somebody to tell those stories and allowing access to them, because in some cases they're not always easy to do with kids or with medical things or with war. The other part is everybody's story, I guess, is good enough on their own without the sort of gimmick of the sort of way of telling it. But I think there are some, and this case was one of them, and there are others that I think drawing allows, because it isn't a photograph and it isn't scary, and we don't imagine we're going to be shocked. It gives a kind of way in to people to look at it. It allows people to look at it because they know that it's okay. Because I've sort of comprehended it and had to make it beautiful in order for you to look at it, even if it is a war zone or a girl's head being operated on, then it's still, it allows sort of time. And I guess that's the key.
Yeah, and that is very interesting. I mean, I'm conscious of not getting bogged down in it too much, even though I find it very interesting, because I've had people say no to a portrait places like Rwanda because they believe it'll take a piece of their soul. And who am I to argue with them? You know, whereas they can see that you're not doing that. You're not capturing anything. You're not taking anything. There's no hidden screen or film or whatever it is. So
yeah, and I think they also, without sort of giving too much of getting out of ourselves, they almost also, they probably just don't take it very seriously. They probably don't think it's very good. They probably don't consider it to even represent them in some cases. So, you know, in a way, you can play to the just, you know, what are you, that sort of idea, they're just a stranger sitting in the corner being odd. And that's okay too.
Well, of course it is. Yeah. I think one of the things that is obviously very interesting and unique about you and what you do is that you crossed the border into Syria, you know, from Turkey to go and do this. And yet we haven't spoken about that at all. You know, that, I mean, it's obviously a very adventurous pursuit, you know, hanging out in war zones, conflict zones, dangerous places.
Yeah, it is. I always think that when people, I have conversations with people about this, that I have disappointing answers to those questions. Is it scary? what does your mother think? Isn't it dangerous? And no, the answer is that places like Syria and Iraq, when I was there, were dangerous places to be. But but there is something I used drawing as a bit of a safety net, in order for me to be able to do it, I need to be able to sit down or stand for 10, 20, 30 minutes or an hour. And so if I can't do that, then I am probably in the wrong place. It doesn't take particularly long. It doesn't always take long. I think people assume that I'm sort of setting up an easel on a rooftop in Mosul and ducking, but I'm not. You know, I'm sitting with a bit of paper and a pen, and I'm often with photographers, and you know, I'm not holding anybody up. filmmakers actually, they can take a long time.
There's quite a lot to do.
I'm going to upset a lot of people on this, but there's a lot to do, and you've got to have couple of takes. But it's quite a good, I enjoy working with alongside journalists and filmmakers, because there is, it kind of buys me time. If I'm on my own, then I feel guilty, and I'm always like rushing and making sure that everyone doesn't want to leave.
I can't tell whether you're downplaying it. Well, there's three things. You're either downplaying it, or you genuinely don't believe it's adventurous, or it just isn't. And I don't think that one's very likely.
Good question. I think it's, I don't associate those trips to, with, I find it difficult to associate them with like being brave or being fearless or it being adventurous, because I think that the people that I found when I was there are in fact, it's their part of the world, and I'm there as an imposter doing a job for a week or 2 weeks. And so I think not too much attention should be put on it, but because I think they're it's sort of part of life, and they're living through it, and it's the drawings are supposed to be of them and not of the other bits. not very well articulated.
No, but it's very interesting. Very interesting, because it almost feels like you are, and I'm just, you know, full disclaimer, I'm not trying to be unkind, I just am exploring the theme. It feels as though you don't want it to be about you at all. And whilst I recognize that the drawings aren't, the process of creating them is fundamentally about you.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an age old fly on the wall, but we'd like to be able to watch it we'd like to be able to witness it and record it and tell it without being an influencer on it. But the moment you put a camera or a microphone or a piece of paper or a stranger in a room, it does change it. You're right. I think I set out for it to be, I think in its purest form, reportage illustration should tell the story of the other person without the influence of you or me in it. But that is tricky, because inevitably the better drawings or the better conversations are of the things that I'm reacting to.
Of course, because they're of you.
Yeah. So how can I deflect off this conversation? No, you're absolutely right. But I think having got to know places like, well, people and the situation in Syria since I was there 10 years ago, 8 years ago, but now, you know, 10 years on, it's still the same war. I feel sensitive when someone says, and not that you've done this, but if there is a suggestion that I've been brave or adventurous, or because actually I know the realities of that, and that I speak to people a lot through the little charity that I set up every day about like proper, unchosen acts of bravery for their own people and countries, and so it seems odd to have it directed in my direction.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
No, that's, I can't argue with that. I mean, what I could ask you is to define adventure.
Well, that's easier. I think the adventure part for me is linked to making the drawing, and so it can be the bits that I get excited about are not necessarily comparatively very little time in places like in the Middle East, sort of on the front line, but the bits that I sort of get excited about are the bits that people missed or that photographers and news teams didn't spend time doing. So I did a story in Lebanon, and I sat in the homes of people in the Bekaa Valley, Syrian refugees, and I just drew their belongings that they'd brought over the mountains and into their new lives. And they were extraordinary sets of things, the most, you know, it's the stuff that you would never imagine were the things that you grabbed when you thought that your house was going to be bombed or that you fled. A couple of like teddy bears, the remote control for the TV that's left behind, a teapot, broken phone chargers, all these things that kind of we all know and are very real, and we've got a drawer full of them at home. And there was one woman who'd fled with her two kids. They'd both grabbed teddy bears, and she had, in the rush, she just grabbed the drawer that she knew the torch was in. They were leaving at night and they were going over the hill through the dark, and when they got to the next place, she had this like set of belongings that were the only things left of her home, and they didn't know when they were going back. So by the time I got there, they laid them out for me to draw, when it was sort of some nice things and some, you know, broken bits of plastic, and the passport that didn't work anymore, and a clock off the wall. And so that isn't anything other than it's just using drawing at its best to describe what I found. So the adventure part is, I guess, linked to making that sort of picture, describe what was there.
This is difficult, but does it feel voyeuristic?
Yeah, I think so. I think I was drawing once in a, I'll sort of describe the moment that I felt the most voyeuristic. I was drawing in a hospital and children's ward between the Syrian border, or inside Syria, just inside from the Turkish border, a place called Bab al-Hawar. And I'm kind of ushered into the room, like, you know, you're here as a journalist. If you want to see this, then here's the children's ward. And there's three kids in bed, all of them with a parent sitting outside them. And I've got my board. It's quite unwieldy. And I start drawing this little boy called Ahmed, who's in the middle. And he has lost his mother, his brother, and his right leg about 72 hours before. And his dad was sitting at the end of the bed, dressed completely in black, sort of inconsolable. And the nurse comes in and she sort of sees that I'm drawing something. And so she goes across the room and says, well, you know, if you like pulls the sheets off him to show his naked body and the stump, like, you know, if you're here, this is, you know, if you want to see what's really happened, then this is it, you know, draw this, sort of daring me, as it were, to draw it. And then the dad is saying, well, you know, art can't change anything. And then there's a bloke in the corner whose son is in the other room, and he's translating and saying, yeah, this is exactly what you should be doing. This is what the other, take these drawings home and show people. This is what's happened to us. And the drawing is half, I'm still feeling it now, even doing it now. The drawing is half finished because I just remember, I think, and the only reason I can think of that is because once I'd done it, first of all, didn't want to ruin it. And second of all, I just sort of wanted to get out of there. But there is it's also a thing that applies to artists, this putting up of a board, like holding a camera up between you, a sort of defense mechanism. And I remember just sort of thinking that I should just get on with it and draw and just treating it like a, you know, an exercise. So I think it is voyeuristic, but I think it's incredibly sensitive and kind of honest way of doing it. And I think one of its criticisms, probably from a journalistic point of view, is that I would always draw probably in favor of the people that are in front of me. I'm drawing them because they're telling me their story. And so it's their point of view, and it's difficult to, and I can't necessarily, obviously the story itself can be checked and checked again, but the actual drawing is always in favor of the person that's in front of you, because you are difficult to be distant.
Yeah, but there's no such thing as, you know, impartial creativity. Whether that's, it just doesn't work. It's impossible.
Yeah, sure. But I think when I look at my mates that are doing like proper journalism, I think that the level to go to write a piece or a book or is beyond. I mean, it's hard to do in a drawing, basically. So yeah, that's to be still learning about that, I think.
So are you not a proper journalist?
I don't know if I am. I mean, in the sense that the work that I've done has contributed to stories in newspapers and magazines, and I've talked about them and told them on all the on all the things that you would associate with journalists, BBCs and CNNs. And in that sense, yes, but I feel like I feel a bit of an outsider, I guess, in that sense. It's incredibly difficult to get work commissioned from like the news industry. I'm always the one pitching them. It's rarely the other way around. And so I think the stories stand up as journalistic, but I'm not necessarily what I would imagine as a journalist, although I think it is very much reportage and journalistic.
Does it matter?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Maybe it does matter, but I know I don't think it does. I mean, I think the bit that I'm good at is making a drawing and writing down in the words of the person I'm sitting in front of what their experience was. And I don't think that matters whether it ends in my case, I don't mind where it ends up. I aim it at newspapers because it gives a chance to have the story and the picture side by side, which I think is a great formula. But I don't think it matters if it ends up on the gallery wall or on a screen or a... So, no, I don't think it does matter.
It's very interesting.
I suppose it matters if you're trying to make a living from it, because you need to have somewhere to put it and someone needs to pay for it.
No, that is... I mean, that's a very significant point, because I, you know, let's speak frankly... I'm trying to work out whether or not you believe that what you do has value, and whether or not you're content with what you do, and whether or not you're confident with it and about it. But actually, is it more of a commercial angle that is the struggle?
That's a good question, isn't it? I think it's... I probably won't stop doing what I'm doing or approaching because I just think it's, yeah, I love doing it, and it gives a real kind of purpose, and it allows finding people and places that otherwise would never happen. So in that sense, very comfortable. I don't know whether it's but you're right, there is a discomfort in my voice about whether it fits in with what other people are expecting. It's an incredibly comfortable thing to feel and do in a different part of the world, but coming back here and trying to sell it, it's more difficult.
Yeah. And do you think that's because of the way the world's changed and public appetite?
I think there's more appetite than ever for stories and a way to get them around, for people to see them. But I think illustration is often overlooked as a way of doing that. I think you, as you say at the beginning, why not take a photograph? Is the thing that I'm up against the most. It's cheaper. There's probably one online already, it's what we assume the audience wants, because we've now become so brilliant at looking at them. So, in every sort of pitch that I have to go to, I first of all have to explain why it might be a good thing,
why would illustration be good on this page instead of a photograph? And then I have to pitch the idea afterwards. And that works. For the majority of the time, it works. But I think it would all stop tomorrow if I stopped making phone calls.
Yeah, but that's, I'm 32. I mean, that's the story of the last 10 years for me. And I take photographs and I make films. I mean, things are slightly different these days, but that's just being a creative person working in the commercial world.
Yeah. No, I understand that.
So if you won the lottery, what would you do?
I wouldn't change anything. I'd probably be lots of things to change, but from a working point of view, it's a very affordable thing to do, doing pen and ink drawings on paper. They're not like big sculptures or oil paintings or so. Say if sort of money was no object, then I would I think this way of working is I like the basicness of it, and it's not about expensive equipment or sort of immediate delivery. That's the point. It's about sitting down with people and going through those hoops and seeing what comes out at the end of it.
So it feels definitely like a tangent or going back in time a little bit, but do you work with fixers and other people? Because I feel like the conversation we've had is I like to draw things and I do it in, I mustn't say adventurous or interesting places, but you know exactly what I mean. Places that are very different from, the South Bank in London. How do you get there? How do you, physically go from...
Yeah. The same way that all the that you would, or the other journalists or filmmakers are going. I went to Armenia before Christmas, and that was a couple of COVID tests plus a flight to Yerevan, and I was with a friend who was writing. Doing some writing, and we were working together. So in the same way, try and find a fixer. Try and find a fixer that understands that I'm not trying to take a photograph. And then those relationships are then as important as any. In fact, perhaps more important. It takes a couple of days to explain that they're gonna get into that rhythm of working that. They're learning that you want a slightly different thing from the next person. So, in the case of a place like Armenia and Kurdistan, when the war was happening in Mosul, that was also a very easy place to get to, and flight to Erbil, visa on arrival, stay in a nice hotel. Nice-ish hotel, and then you could make your way across, get a press card to Mosul, and get embedded with whoever you wanted. But the fixer was a key role in that, and we had a classic guy called McKean, which I imagine people listening to will know, because he was the kind of one to get you in and out of Mosul, and he had a combination of Iraqi plus Brummie accent. He'd lived in England for 10 years working in a scrapyard, and went home at the beginning of the war to help the war effort. And he would fix, sort of within reason, whatever you wanted. So sometimes you get you get that, and then sometimes you get the opposite. And in that sense, it's useful that I think that is, to answer your earlier question, there is a kind of journalistic like part to that. I'm there very much part of that, but the sort of wheel. But as an artist, I think the best way is just to put a board under your arm and wander around.
It's a very unique, I use that word very sparingly. I hardly ever say it. I very have strong views on it, but what you do is unique. I've never come across anybody else that draws in war zones.
Yeah, that's... There are a few other people doing it, but not necessarily in the same way. There are variations, of the same theme, I guess. But typically, you have to look back in history books to find people who sat down and drawn. And I suppose it's not always war zones, but some of the better drawings are also, I did this great, I thought it was a good set of drawings, in a, for a German magazine in a court, in a neo-Nazi terror trial. You're not allowed to draw in the courts in England. It's complete chaos. You basically have to go into the court. They're not allowed a pen or paper. You look at the person that's in the dock, and then you run outside to the press room, and then you draw. And then you do it again and again and again. You're allowed to do it as many times as you want, but you're not allowed to draw in there, which is why they sometimes look a bit odd, those drawings. And then, but in Germany, we got permission from the court, and I was allowed to sit in there. And so there was this... woman called Beate Schapper who'd confessed to bombing the Turkish hairdressers, but then had refused to speak, and she it was a huge court case, went on for 3 years. And so there was all these different characters in the court that had to be drawn, the judge, the plaintiffs, the room, the TV cameras were allowed in the beginning and then they were thrown out, the press box was packed. And so it was this a great opportunity just to sit and draw and know that no one else could see. There were going to be no other pictures of this other than what I had made of it. And then there was a real kind of reward in that being published in Süddeutsche Zeitung, which is like a big magazine in southern Germany. So that's when I think it works the best. So although I try and perhaps make excuses about being a journalist, it sort of comes into its own when I know there's a real relief when it's published, and I know that the story of Ahmed or the story of Mama Nazak or Mustafa, I think the end of it, the Iraqi artists are told, then the kind of the pressure's off. I sort of did what I said I was going to do. But there's huge uncertainty for me every time about whether that's going to happen.
That's amazing, though. Especially, it just seems... I mean, I'd never considered that they weren't allowed to take photographs in there, I suppose. But...
Or draw.
Yeah.
I think in America you can draw in some courts.
So, okay, you're going to get really grumpy with me. But do you consider yourself to be adventurous and brave?
No, I don't think so. Brave in the sense that I'm putting some, I don't know whether bravery is the right word. I think it could be braver for an artist to show their work because it's sort of bearing everything they've ever learned or known, or the fear is more that it's going to go wrong and that it won't live up to it, I think. But I think people say, why do you always want, why are you trying to go out of your comfort zone to, I don't know, wherever it is, West Africa or Afghanistan. But actually, I feel like it's almost into my comfort zone. It's ordinary. People are honest. I am doing the thing that I've spent 15 years practicing. And that's a very basic thing, which is just to sit down on the floor and copy down what I see in front of me. Those places have had histories, are often misunderstood as more dangerous than they are. But because of the role that I am in there, which is a very sort of very, about repeating myself, but it is a very kind of non-threatening one. I think that I can do those, I can be there without it being a particularly dangerous thing to do. I do shy away from words like that, and there is an element to it, but I think it's about approach and planning and end result.
I think that's fair. It's not a disappointing answer, just to, you know, I'm not looking for you to tell me, you know, how brave and adventurous you are. But no, because to me, you know, as soon as you said comfort zone, I was with you. I mean, it's one of my pet hates, actually, is this implication that we're stepping out into the unknown.
I think you can just be, you can go, I can go halfway around the world and be in a place where I don't speak the same language, sleeping on the floor, and you know, everything is in theory out of your comfort zone, but I can feel incredibly relaxed, and then I can come back to a studio in South Bank and, well, you know, a year ago, go and meet some friends in the pub and feel completely distant.
So I think what I'm really sat here thinking is, you know, as a 32-year-old white man from England, I feel like life has often lacked a little bit of purpose and meaning. It's very easy to, you know, have a nice, comfortable life. I mean, comfort's addictive. That's one of the problems. But living purposefully and finding reason is a very difficult thing, I would argue. Do you think you have purpose and reason?
Yeah. I think the drawing gives me both.
What would you do without it?
Well, I run a little charity, which I started when I came back from Syria with some friends. I could spend a lot of time doing that. I often use it as a way of procrastinating from my work. but it's just a great, as I say, if you're working on your own, to have like another reason to like, to be doing something and to be in touch with that part of the world it sort of occurred to me that although the people I drew out there in Iraq or in Mustafa, this like wonderful artist who I met one afternoon, he'd been beaten by ISIS for drawing in his town. So he'd been drawing as well, and he'd been beaten up by ISIS for making making pictures of what he'd seen them do to people, and it was his way of, it was very cathartic for him and a real kind of therapy. But I only spent an afternoon with him, and it occurred to me that for him, he probably hasn't thought about it again since, but it was an incredibly meaningful moment for me. And so I think I would spend more time trying to get this charity, which we support teachers and doctors in Syria, paying their wages. And it's pretty unsexy, but it would give me purpose and reason outside of something else.
Do you want to just give me the quick lowdown on what it is?
It's called Hands Up. It's called the Hands Up Foundation. And we raise about £500,000 a year and send it to 20 medical staff in the north of Syria and 300 kids in Lebanon, Syrian kids. We don't pay for their education, but we pay for the sort of support and stationery packs and for it to happen. And it's those sorts of the doctors was the ones that I'm some of the ones that I met originally when I was there. So it comes out and I drew at the time. So that's why it's hard to talk when you sort of perhaps why it's sort of unclear when I talk about, you know, the two are so closely interwoven between how I feel and what I draw that it's difficult to divide the two into kind of job or any of the other difficult things that you've asked me.
Well, I'm not sorry. So
no, you're very good at it. Well done.
Well, thanks. So you haven't asked me to do this. I imagine it's going to make you extremely uncomfortable, but can you tell me about the book and where people can buy it and where they can find it? And
yes, I can. Thank you for asking about it. It's called Drawn Across Borders. And it's where possible, the words of the people that I met, and the drawings that accompanied those stories. So in Syria and Serbia, in the kind of warehouses where these refugees were waiting, and economic migrants in Tajikistan and bits in East Africa as well. And it's available on. It's published on the 1st of April. It's been put back, but you can pre-order it online. Obviously not from the place that we don't pre-order books.
That we don't talk about, yeah.
But one of the other nice independent bookshops. And it's sort of more articulate versions of what I've tried to explain to you. And mostly drawings. It's aimed at... One of the reasons for doing it was because there must be loads of classrooms of kids. It's aimed at 10 to 18-year-olds. But with like grown-up drawings and the stories that I've explained, and especially in London, South London, where I now live and work, there must be loads of classrooms where stories of, you know, everyone in the class is probably connected in an indirect way to a story of migration, but they've probably never talked about it because we still have a problem in this country about sort of accepting that people might be from somewhere else because we simply don't. In the UK, we don't. Migration is not something that factors into our lives. But if you have travelled like I have to Syria or to Afghanistan, this is something that is part of their life. They may expect to do it. They definitely know someone who's done it. They've probably got family in another part of the world. And so it isn't. It's not about being sort of putting up the barriers. It's about just being accepting that that is. Something that happens, and the book tries to normalize that, and it spans a few of the stereotypes, you know, all the old favorites that they never want to go home, that, you know, they're just looking for work, and doesn't appear to be any consistent evidence of that ever, and that was what I found. And so it's mostly pictures and a few words to try and explain that along the way.
Yes. I always ask people two questions. I was going to let you off, but I'm not going to. What worries you?
What worries? The climate. I'm more anxious about that than I think I am about anything else. And I'm going to make some, I'm already starting to make some drawings around that subject. I think in particular that feeling of helplessness in the face of enormous task. How could drawings or something creative help anybody comprehend, you know, the enormous figures, you know, where the science hasn't worked or hasn't connected. Is there a way of understanding it? So that scares me.
What brings you hope?
Young people. I've got a 12-year-old brother, and we have some great conversations about the world. I just feel that people of that age, they're just right, aren't they? About, I mean, they're not right about anything, but they also just might be right about everything. And so I just try to sort of think that's hopeful. And maybe it's terrifying at the same time, but it's very reassuring to have conversations with him.
And then I said two questions, but the finale is, you said to me at some point in this conversation that in a hospital ward somewhere, somebody said to you that art can't change anything.
Yeah.
Can art change anything?
Yes, I think it can. I think it can influence things. And I think in a world of, I think in a world where the emphasis is put on kind of maths and English and being very businesslike and on time and structured and scientific, and I think we have forgotten that there is a space for something artistic, whether that's color or rhythm or language or anything in between.
Nice. We'll leave it there. Thanks for listening. Check out George's book, Drawn Across Borders, and make sure you grab a copy. I've got one on my desk right now, and it's a wonderful insight into the corners of the world that we usually see through the eyepiece of a camera. The podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft and produced and distributed by Pip Saunders and Alex Hall. It's edited by Kate Bullivan. You can keep in touch at info@theadventurepodcast.co.uk, and you can stay up to date on Instagram @theadventurepodcast.